Good morning. My name is Ron, and I'm an alcoholic. That's Ron B. Some folks know me by Ronnie. I used to introduce myself as Ronnie because I thought perhaps I need to know who was addressing me when I met people. I had this idea that I was going to get famous in an anonymous program. Imagine that. The AA ego is sometimes still alive and well. But it is a pleasure to be here today, this morning, and we just thank Amy and the committee for inviting us. Don't really know what you were thinking when you did that, but we're happy to be here nonetheless. My wife and I had an opportunity to come up a little bit early. We went hiking on the Appalachian Trail, and as I was thinking about, you know, speaking is such a great thing for me to do because it's a time for me to reflect on where I came from and where I'm at. And so as I talk to you today, my goal is to paint a picture of what it was like, who I was, what happened, and what it's like today, who I am today. Because I assure you, the man that came to AA almost, 31 and a half years ago is not the man that stands before you today. That man, if I still was that man, I would drink again. But my sobriety date is August 28th, 1991. My home group is by the book Men's Group of Alcoholics Anonymous on Monday night in Riverview. And I'm glad to tell you that AA is alive and well in Riverview, a suburb of Tampa, and we're saving lives down there through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have so much gratitude to AA. I'm passionate about the program. I'm passionate about the God component of the program. In my mind, God used AA to bring me to a place of sanity. Without God, I don't have a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's kind of my message, my theme. But as I was hiking, I realized that there's a lot of corollaries in hiking and recovery. Sometimes you have these ascents, and they're tough, and you have to work at it. And as you climb that mountain and things are really hard, you just have to press yourself. Sometimes you just have to go step by step, one step at a time. But when you get to the top, you're always rewarded with something beautiful. It may just be the sense of accomplishment of arriving. It may be just relief that you're not climbing anymore. But a lot of times, it's just beautiful, a beautiful vista you get to see. Sometimes we get to see things that nobody else gets to see, just like us in this room. We get to live a life that so many people don't get an opportunity to live because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm just excited to be here, excited to be a part of this. But let me start by doing something. I'm copying somebody else in this. There's a prayer that was developed from the literature called the set-aside prayer. And I'd like to start today with the prayer. And it says this. If you'd like to pray with me, close your eyes. If not, just listen as I read this. God, today, help me to set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about others, and everything I think I know about my own recovery, so that I may be an open mind with a new experience with all these things. Please help me to see the truth. And I'll also ask to help me to speak the truth. Never really know what I'm going to say when I get up here, except that I want to share what it was like, and that's where I'll start. I won't spend a lot of time on that part of my story because we know what it was like, right? I want to qualify myself to the newcomer and to those of you who wonder how this guy in this suit can relate to me if I'm living in a halfway house and my life is in a toilet and I lost my job and my car's repossessed and my house is in foreclosure. I lived all those things. I took my first drink when I was 11 years old. A couple of indicators that I was going to be a true full-blown alcoholic very quickly was that drink was an old Milwaukee beer. And I came back for more. Okay, so that was one indicator. But another indicator was that I didn't have to learn how to drink alcoholically. It was natural. By the time I took my first drink, I was not raised. I heard someone mention a pack of wolves. My folks did the best they could. But by the time I was 11, I had been abused in every way a child can be abused. Emotionally, sexually, physically, every way that you can be abused. And I'm not held bondage by those things today. I talk freely about it because I've been set free from those things. But when I took that first drink, I want you to know that I felt like I never fit in. I loathed myself. I didn't just dislike myself. I loathed myself. At 11 years old, I just knew that I was different. I was always told that I was a black sheep of the family, and then once upon a time I came to AA and I met the rest of the herd, you know, and I finally fit in, right? So I'm glad I'm here. But that first drink was life-changing. It didn't change how I hated myself. It didn't change how I felt awkward. It didn't change that I was a little crew-headed, cut, fat kid in the back of the class with a plaid shirt that he was handed down by two brothers. It didn't change all that. It just made it didn't matter. It just didn't matter. And so at the age of 12, I began a criminal career. I'll tell you that my story took me to prison. I spent a total of 27 years behind bars in Florida State Prison. Another 10 years on felony paper. And so today I stand before you free. I have my passport, imagine that. They let me out of prison about 10 years early for good conduct because of the program Alcoholics Anonymous. They let me off of my post-prison supervision 28 years early, giving me accolades of my thorough rehabilitation. And I was able, just recently, as I work in the law now, to stand before that same judge and give the credit where credit was due. And it's to God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for changing me from the inside out. So at the age of 12, my first co-defendant and I broke into a community center. And if you can think, you really can come down from Old Milwaukee Beer, because we stole a six-pack of Pabst Blue Ribbon. Now, that beer was warm, and I'm a fair guy. We split that thing right down the middle. I got five, he got one. And I got my first buzz, and it would continue. I drank alcoholically pretty consistently, and I don't know how I got through high school. I don't think I was supposed to graduate. At 17, I got arrested for my first felony, pulled a rifle on somebody, told them I was going to kill him. You see, when you're hurting inside the way I was hurting inside, and you're full of rage, that rage and that anger is just a cover-up. It's just to keep you at arm's length. Because inside I was dying. I was hurting. I needed to belong, and I didn't know what to belong to, and I couldn't. And I knew that if you got close to me and found out who I was, you wouldn't want anything to do with me. That's just how I lived. So I went to, in high school, most people are looking to get their prom sweetheart and go to the prom, right? I was looking to stay out of prison. And so it was a small town in Arkansas. I grew up in Florida, by the way, St. Petersburg. And about the age of 12, we moved to Arkansas. And that was a big culture change for this guy. And I love being here in Georgia. I love hearing your accents. And you may think you don't have an accent. Everybody else does. But in Arkansas, I picked up a nice southern accent. And when I joined the Air Force, again, they told me I had to lose my accent. And I said, what accent? But they gave me a tape recorder because I was an air traffic controller in the Air Force. And I had to lose that accent. If you're not a praying person, next time you fly, think about me as an air traffic controller, FAA certified, full-blown alcoholic. Perhaps that'll help your prayer life a little bit. But so in high school, my class came to the trial. I was guilty of sin, folks. And I lied, and I cheated, and I manipulated, and I got a good attorney, and I got off. And I was found not guilty. And I was able to enlist in the Air Force early, and I did so right out of high school. I just knew I had to get out of town. My family was an embarrassment to me. And I knew they were. And I just needed to get someplace. I was poor, and I lived in a town with people that I just didn't fit in. But you know what? I played football. I wore the uniform. I was even a captain of the football team. I'd go out on the field, and I didn't fit in. I joined the Air Force, and I put on the blue uniform, and I went through basic training and did all the things I was supposed to do, and I stood there in that open ranks when we graduated from basic training, and I didn't fit in. No matter where I went, I did not fit in. So I took captive a young lady that I met, called that marriage, and she was a beautiful young lady, and I was just a wreck. I didn't have relationships. I took captives. I lived a dual life. In uniform, I did what I was supposed to do. But every time I was out of uniform or off duty, I was drinking alcoholically. And I was still full of that rage. and I would get in bar fights and I would just pick fights with people and you just continue to do that long enough and you get in trouble. And just before I was to reenlist, they told me I couldn't reenlist because I had been arrested for another assault. And so I left the Air Force on probation and moved back to Clearwater. I joined the Air Force to see the world, by the way, and they sent me to Cocoa Beach, which is Florida again. You know, so I guess I was just destined to be in Florida. And so got out of the Air Force, and I tell you, I can give lectures on career degression. I went from air traffic control to pest control in 6 weeks. That's the kind of stuff I can teach. And so there I was with my little spray can. Nothing against any pest controllers. If you're in here, don't spray me. But I was, they gave me keys to hundreds of apartments a day. Wow. They could have just not even paid me. And because I was going into people's apartments, and this is back in the early 80s. I don't know how many of you remember, but everyone had those little TV trays, and they were full of all kind of dry goods, and they slipped right under your sofa. Everybody did that. I never got the memo on that, but apparently everybody else did. I would go into half the apartments, and I would find those little TV trays, and I was helping myself, and I was drinking your booze out of the refrigerator. I was eating your food out of your refrigerator. I just had absolutely no respect. And I had a sense of entitlement to just, you know, I was a criminal. That's what it was. I was a criminal. And so I gave my talk one time in St. Pete, and I realized I was really close to Clearwater, and I had to do a quick check. Does anybody in here remember being stolen, you know, robbed from? And you come home, I knew I had five pieces of chicken in there, you know. But fortunately, nobody remembered me. I did that for 2.5 years. And by the way, when you go into someone else's home, even if you have a pass key and you eat out of the refrigerator or you steal their property, they call that burglary. And I had a bunch of them, hundreds of them. And the detective finally connected the dots. I had a route book, and he saw that, you know, there was a very clear line there that he could follow. And so they gave me a choice: take 7 years in the Florida Department of Corrections, or he would prosecute me on every one of those burglaries, second-degree felony, punishable by 15 years, and he'd bury me in prison. And so I took the deal, and I got 7 years in prison. I was 22 years old, just turning 23. Back then I had blonde hair, bluer eyes, and my little white butt showed up in Florida State Prison. And I'm going to talk a little bit about racism, because prison is a very race-filled place. I'm not racist. I hope you're not either. And by the way, if no one told you that they love you today, I love you today. I may not even know you, but God has... I'm Irish, by the way, so I get passionate. I may even cry. I see Kleenex down there. It's going to be okay. Guys can cry, okay? It's going to be all right. But I used to be such a cold-hearted person. I cared nothing about you except what I could get from you. But today, I have a soft and compassionate heart. I cry at sappy movies. It's really pretty pitiful. But I'm okay with that. So I went to prison. And I'll tell you that for a young white guy in prison, in Florida State Prison, it was pretty tough. And I came out of prison 4.5 years later, more violent, more rage-filled. I knew I was, you know, I had been raped as a kid. I wasn't going to get raped in prison. And I fought. And what should have been an 18-month stay turned into 4.5 years because I was in so much trouble. But I came out of prison with one thing for sure I knew. I didn't want to go back to prison. I never connected the fact that drinking had taken me there. You see, when you're filled with this rage and this anger that I was filled with, alcohol removed inhibitions, removed the controls, and that just blew up. And that's the way I lived. So I got out of prison. I went to college, straight-A student. We're not stupid people, are we? We're not. We have doctors and lawyers and pest controllers. And we have all kinds of people with all kinds of accomplishments, and we can do anything we want. And I think it was Chris that was telling us yesterday, you know, whatever you want to do, it's never too late to recreate yourself. You know, and we can do that here. And I did that here. So I went to college. I was a business major, minor in marketing, straight A's. An organization by the name of Phi Beta Kappa came and invited me to join them. And this little guy with a pocket protector and 15 pens and black rimmed glasses was looking at me. And I was the old convict with tattoos and stuff. You know, I thought I was a tough guy. Who is this pencil neck geek talking to me? I didn't know what Phi Beta Kappa was. But my alcoholism continued. 4.5 years later, after getting out of prison, I found myself again in a holding cell. And I did not know why I was there. It was another burglary. This time, apparently, I had tried to steal, either steal a lady's car or her drugs or her money. I don't know. I was in a blackout. And I do not. And I want to give you a little caveat here. Anything bad that I did in my life, I take full responsibility for. I don't blame my alcoholism. I don't blame anyone except me for doing what I did. Anything good I've done in my life, I give God all the credit for that. Because if it wasn't for God's intervention in my life, I would not be standing here, and I would never have been able to do anything of any merit whatsoever. But I had to ask the jailer why I was in jail. I had committed a first-degree felony. Let me tell you what kind of criminal I am. I'm the kind of guy, and this really did happen, I got drunk at a party that was the day before my court date. That's what we do, right? You know? So just in case I don't get to get home the other night, and somebody slipped something in my drink. Back in those days, they had little things they slipped in your drink. And I had a really bad experience. But I remember climbing through my window at home, which I thought was a bit odd. And I lay down in my bed in my white underwear and black socks. This becomes important in a moment. Sorry to put that image in your mind. But... And I heard someone talking in my home. I got up, armed myself with a little bitty steak knife, and I chased these people out of my house. And I found myself standing in a parking lot in an apartment complex I did not live in my white underwear and black socks. It was about 2:00 in the morning. They call that midnight armed burglary. That's the kind of criminal I am. So I was invited back into the Department of Corrections for an extended stay. I'll tell you that I was, and this is a part of the story of what happened, right? So that was what it was like. What happened was I got a crooked judge, and that judge wanted a bribe from my family and I. He wanted $5,000, and I would go to drug rehab. I did not know that. My family and I were perhaps not on the best of terms. That little town of Arkansas, every time I had a brush with the law, I call it a brush, it was actually an explosion, it made the front page news, and it was very embarrassing to them. And so we weren't on the best of terms. But this judge, he wanted some money, and my dad would not give it to him. I don't blame my dad, it wasn't his fault. I was a grown man. And so the judge, instead of sending me to a treatment facility for 18 months, sent me to prison as a career criminal, fifth felony conviction, a habitual violent felony offender, incorrigible, and he sentenced me to 70 years. When he sentenced me to 70 years, my attorney, who I now learned later was a sellout attorney, he was scooting away from me. And I said, did he say 7 years? Because that's what I scored out. They have these neat things, these score sheets. If you do this crime and you have that record and you hurt somebody, if you don't hurt somebody, you get points for all that kind of stuff. And your points add up to your sentence. And so my points were only 7 to 9 years. But if you habitualize somebody, all that's laid aside. And so I was sentenced to prison to die. You can't survive a 70-year sentence. And I was sent to the worst of prisons. And I was out on bond for a little while, and the judge made me go to AA and have my paper signed. And please don't ever criticize the people who come into the rooms and have their paper signed. I did not want to be here. I did not qualify for membership because I did not have a desire to stop drinking. I just wanted to keep the girl, keep the job, and stay out of prison. They sentenced me to prison. I lost a job, and a girl disappeared. You could say that my first little bit in AA was complete failure. But when I was going to the meetings, I saw something and I heard something that I had never seen or heard before. First, as we've heard already, I was asked to come back. You know that guy that sits in the back of the room, right next to the door, and he has that hard look on his face, and he's trying to keep everybody away. That was me. I was dying inside. I wanted something, but I didn't know what I wanted. I saw something in your eyes that I wanted, and I couldn't really put my fingers on it, but now I know it was peace. It was being comfortable in your own skin. I had never experienced that. And so I kept coming back because I had to. When I was in jail, I volunteered for a substance abuse program prior to my trial and sentencing. I pled guilty, and the judge wouldn't accept it. He demanded I go to trial, you know. Because if I pled guilty, he might have to be lenient, I guess, now in retrospect. Man, did I hate that judge. When I found out that he was crooked, I put a tattoo on my right shoulder. And I'll show you later if I'm wearing short sleeves. But the tattoo is of an arm reaching through the razor wire holding a lightning bolt. And on his base it said, Justice. I was a marksman in the Air Force. I've been hunting since I was a kid. I'm a good shot. And my plan was, to be transparent, I was going to get out of prison. I was going to kill him. And that was my plan. Every night I laid my head on that bunk in a prison cot. I thought about killing him and the different ways that I would do that. Full of rage, full of anger. And also very busy blaming other people for where I was at. So they sentenced me to prison and I went. It was a violent place. And you know what? I fit right in. I had been here before. I knew what to do. So I started all kinds of criminal enterprises. I had stores, illegal stores in different dorms, and I had people that worked for me, and I was a loan shark, and I had friends that had friends in the gangs, and if you borrowed money from me and you didn't pay back, you'd pay. And you know what? That was while I was going to AA meetings. Do you know, and this is still part of the story about what happened, it's very possible to be at AA without being in AA. And that's one of the worst places you could ever be, because you have one foot in the old life and one foot in a new life, and you don't know which way to go. So I'm doing all this criminal activity, and they lock me up into confinement, solitary confinement, under investigation, because of all these criminal things that I'm doing. What occurred to me, and for the first time in my life, I think that God allowed me to see me through His eyes. And I saw that I had ruined my military career because I could not conform, and I was rejected from the military. And I saw that I had not conformed to society's rules, and I had been sent to prison because I was rejected from society. And now that I was in a society of criminals, I was deemed too dangerous to be in open population. And that was who I had become. And I'll tell you that in working the steps, something pretty amazing happened. I was not looking for a spiritual experience. I was not wanting to be a... Gosh, when you talked about God, I got angry. I got really angry, and I just wanted to push you away. And that's nothing new. A lot of us go through that, don't we? In the beginning of AA, way back when Bob and Bill were just starting out, there was a guy named Ed. You can read about him in the third tradition of the 12 and 12. And Ed was an atheist. And at every opportunity, he would tell you that he was an atheist. And he was very vocal about it. It was very upsetting to the founders of this program. Because this is a program on page 45 that says the main purpose of this book is to introduce you to a relationship with a higher power. Out of necessity, therefore, we were going to talk about God. And when you sold that to me, I was not receiving that. I was agnostic, if not atheist. I could not believe that a loving God would allow things to happen that happened to me as a child. I realize today that it's not God's fault that people do bad things. Hurt people, don't they? I did. So I went to that little cell. Oh, let me finish the story about Ed. So everyone in the program, and it was a very small program then, thought, well, you know what? He's going to relapse and he'll disappear because you can't do this thing without God. But he stayed sober. And he kept coming to meetings. Very frustrating to the people in AA. He kept coming to meetings and they asked him to speak. And man, he was vocal about his atheism. And man, did he upset people. Well, as the story goes in the third tradition, he did relapse. The third tradition is the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And that was what kept him to meetings. They were thinking about kicking him out because he was an atheist. He wouldn't talk about or receive the message of God. And they said, but that's not a requirement for membership. The only requirement is a desire to stop drinking. And he had that. So they allowed him to stay. After his relapse, he came back to AA and he was ready to hear about God. And that was my story. When I came here, I didn't want to hear about God. I got angry when you talked to me about God. I had been educated somewhat about God from here up, nothing down here. And so there I was in a confinement cell. And I'll tell you that something happened there that I can't explain, but it is explained in our literature. It's called a spiritual awakening. In my way of thinking, we have a spiritual awakening, and then we have a lot of spiritual experiences. I cannot have a spiritual experience unless I'm spiritually awake. If I'm spiritually asleep or spiritually dead, I don't do spiritually anything because I'm dead. I'm asleep. And that's the way I was. So, in my mind, God just reached down with his big finger and thumped me on the head and woke me up and allowed me to see my current state. And I came out of that confinement cell a different man. I would still have to serve 20 years in prison, but I would be free long before I walked out of that gate. This is the part of the story about what it's like. And what it's like for me is to walk as a recovered person in prison for 20 years before I got out. And I got out in 2013. Prison, I spoke earlier that I'm going to talk a little bit about race, because prison is a very racial place. People hate each other because of pigmentation of their skin. And I was the victim of racism in prison. And who isn't? If you go to prison, you're going to be a victim of that kind of thinking, that kind of mentality. I'm so glad we don't have that here. And I'm thrilled to see a mixed room of different ethnicities. And I'm so glad that we're part of the same family, because we are. If you believe as I believe, we all came from one set of parents, and here we are. But so there I was in prison. I had a 70-year sentence. I'm a career criminal. I'm not supposed to get out of prison. So what do you do? It was suggested I become a law clerk. Made sense. I could be of service to people there. But let me back up just a moment. When I got out of that confinement cell and I was a different person, I was no longer willing to hurt anybody. That's a tough thing to be when you're in a maximum security prison. When you have that kind of time, you're a dead man walking. They send you to prisons that people are not getting out from. And rapes and robberies and killings are very common in those kind of places. And I don't mean to glorify the prison experience at all. It's horrendous. And most of us come out of prison with scars. But you know what? If you get a relationship with God, he'll heal those scars. And so... the people that worked for me, that had the stores going on and would put down on you and put lumps on your head if you didn't pay your bills and that kind of thing, I was no longer willing to do that, because something had changed. And even the way I talked changed. And I started talking like a Boy Scout in a maximum security prison. Imagine that. And I was happy. I became happy, joyous, and free in a maximum security prison. They used to pull me in, they being the prison guards, used to pull me in regularly to do your analysis because they just figured I was high. How can you be happy? You have a smile on your face. You have to be high. And it gave me plenty of opportunities to share my experience, strength, and hope with prison guards. And I saw some of their lives change, believe it or not. God can use you wherever you go. And so I became a law clerk. I walked into a law library and I was the only white guy in the room. And it was their territory. And they were very clear that this was their territory. The senior law clerk, that's kind of a thing. It's not an official thing, but it's a real thing. He's the guy in charge. His name was Dwight. And he decided to hire me and go against the grain of the other guys who did not want to hire me just because of the color of my skin. And he trained me. And 28 years later, after I was able to get out by God's grace, I stood in a courtroom having written a motion for Dwight and having an attorney represent him. We got him out of prison and I stood in the courtroom. So he had hired me 28 years earlier, and that day I was able to hire him in my company. And that's the way God works. So when you... Yeah, give God a hand for that. Isn't that cool? Just a little thing that you do for someone today, you may never see the fruit that that bears, but it is important. The ripple effect, right? And we talk about that some. So I became a law clerk, and I guess that was God's plan. I know it was, because I got good at it. And I got hundreds of people out of prison. And my life was threatened by administration in different prisons because they didn't like... It was kind of the job security thing, I guess. You know, they didn't want their prison empty. And so my life was threatened. I was thrown in confinement a few times. I was transferred to bad places. I met a lady here who used to live in Perry, Florida. And if you've never been in Perry, Florida, don't go. They have a paper mill there. Have you ever been around a paper mill? Yeah, so don't go. They had a prison there. I was there for a little while, really tough spot. But you know what? In 20 years of walking this program in prison, I never had to put my hands on another man. I never had to. That's the kind of God I came to know in this program. He went before me. And let me tell you a couple instances where that happened that was just so profound. One, when I left the jail, I had to leave my big book behind. And my big book had inscriptions from the guys that I went through the program with. Dear friends who I wanted to stay connected with. But I certainly wanted to keep that big book. They took it from me. I couldn't keep it. 3 years later, after I had been told to pray a simple prayer, and this is a prayer I suggest for all my sponsees and anyone in this room who is equivocal or has some ambiguity about the existence of God. God, if you're real, reveal yourself to me. I've never seen someone pray that prayer where it wasn't answered. One of the first things that happened to me is I went back 8 times, by the way, to jail in court. So they take you from prison, they put you in jail where you don't eat so well. And so in this one of these times I was back, and my old sponsor from the jail came to the jail that night. He picked up the wrong big book when he left the house. He picked up my old big book. And he came to the jail. I had been pulled out of my jail cell early in the morning by mistake. I didn't have court that day. They pull you out and you go to the courthouse and you sit there all day long and you get to eat peanut butter. No, it was actually bologna sandwiches for breakfast, lunch, and dinner while you're there. So I was protesting, but that doesn't go over too well with the prison guards. You go where you're told to go. So I went. So I was pulled out by mistake. My sponsor picked up the wrong big book, and he's walking through a part of the jail where he wasn't supposed to be. It wasn't planned to be. And they had put me in a cell. A maximum security prisoner does not get into a cell that's facing a hallway where civilians are walking up and down with open cells. It just doesn't happen. They had me in that cell. So that's 4 mistakes. And John was walking by. I said, "Hey, John." And he looked at me. He said, "Hey, Ron." Sounds like a surf shop, right? And he says, "Now I know why I picked up this book." And he handed me my big book. Now think about how that happened. That was not a mistake. That was a God divine appointment. And that was one of the first things that happened to me, that I started to see that God was real. There was some other things that were a little bit more traumatic. I was in some race riots, not a part of, but in. And this particular one that I was in, I was of the color that gets beat up, the losing color, right? And so I had to walk across this compound and get to my dorm. You have 5 minutes if a riot kicks off in prison to get to your dorm. If you don't get there, you're considered part of it. You could be shot. And they do call the National Guard and so forth. And they do some things in prison that you never hear about out here. But I was able to walk across that compound as if I was invisible. And I was only armed with my prayer. That's all. God provided me a way to get to my dorm. I knocked on the dorm. The officer opened up. She said, "How in the world did you get here?" And all I could do is point to God. There was another time when I was back in the county jail. And I was volunteering because that's what we do, right? Wherever we go, AAers leave the place just a little bit better than when we found it. That's our goal, right? So I was volunteering in the law library from 12 a.m. to 4 a.m. And there was a time where they had changed the sentencing guidelines and score sheets that I had mentioned, and I had studied that stuff, and I just loved the law. So I was working in the law library, and this young black kid came in. He was, I guess he had an eighth or ninth grade education. He was 17 years old, and he was looking at a pretty heavy sentence. I got 9 years off of his sentence by recalculating his score sheet. The state had messed it up, whether intentionally or unintentionally, I don't know. So he went in front of the judge, my judge, the crooked judge. And the judge said, "Son, you're absolutely right. We're going to take these 9 or 10 years off your sentence." I think it was 9 years off your sentence. But tell us, how did you figure this out? We don't even know how this stuff works. But you got it right. And he said, "A really nice law clerk by the name of Ron, back from prison, helped me." And I could just picture that judge just turning beet red. Because he hated me probably as much or more than I hated him. But you know what? I'll tell you something before I finish the rest of that story. Is one of the things that I was told I had to do was forgive. And forgiveness is not, it's not just a pretty little word we use. It's not a philosophy or a theory. It's a verb. It's something we do. The big book tells us how to do that. We pray for the person. We pray that God would bless that person with every spiritual blessing, every material blessing, everything that they can get in life. We pray for that person. When my sponsor in prison told me that I had to pray for the judge, I didn't really know what he meant. I started to think, well, how about stomach cancer? How about a heart attack? He said, no, that's not what we're talking about. So he clarified, he showed me in the big book, and I started praying. Now, remember, I was that tough guy, wannabe in prison, and I wanted, it was all about image. Prison is a lot about image, right? And I lived on a weight pile, and I was a big guy, and I had 19, 20-inch arms back then, and I wanted to be imposing and intimidating because that kept you away from me and all of that. But my sponsor said I need to pray on my knees in a maximum security prison. And boy, you know what? I don't think there's much in my life was harder than that first time that I got down by that prison bunk and I got on my knees. Because what I thought was, I was going to be prey. You either have predators or prey in an environment like that. And I was afraid that the people that were predators were going to see me as prey and then I would have to kill somebody. And I didn't want to do that. And so I prayed before I started praying. And I said, "God, you know, if this is what you want me to do, then okay, I'll do it." And I got down on my knees and I prayed. I prayed for that judge. And I'll tell you that I did not mean that prayer the first time I said it. See, I believe that we cannot think ourselves into right acting. We need to act ourselves into right thinking. I need to take the steps and my mind will follow. I need to take direction. My definition of a sponsor is someone who's been where I want to go, and I don't know how to get there. I have this little illustration I use, and I fell into a pit, and I couldn't get out of the pit. It was a deep pit. A preacher came by and he said, "Son, you're in the pit." I said, "I can see that, preacher." He said, "I'll pray for you," and he left. I was still in the pit. A psychologist came by and he threw me a book, How to Survive the Pit, or some stupid thing. And that was great. That was nice. Thank you. But I'm still in the pit. Well, an alcoholic came by. He said, "Hey, you're in the pit." Newsflash. And he said, "Do you want to get out of the pit?" And I said, "I sure do." Well, that crazy sucker jumped down in the pit with me. And I said, "What'd you do that for?" He said, "Son, this is where I come from. I've been here before." One of those moments. And I know the way out. Just follow me. And that's what I did. So there I am by that bunk praying, and I'm afraid that these predators, gang members, tough guys, the kind of guys I used to try to be, were going to see me as a target. And I'll tell you something that amazing happened. Those same guys came up to me and then called me by my nickname, Bake. And I said, Bake, we got a lot of respect for what you're doing, man. We see a real change in you. Would you pray for me? Wow. How does that happen? It doesn't unless God is involved. Okay. So the judge finds out that I helped this young fellow with his score sheet. Got 9 years off his sentence. I'm in the county jail. That night I get, that day sometime, I get rolled up. That means the guards tell you to get your stuff. And they put me in solitary confinement. And the solitary confinement cell was pretty ugly. It had human excrement around and vomit and so forth. And so I'm feeling pretty shook up about this. So what do? I clean up the cell, because that's what we do. Get out of ourselves. Get about some service. So I clean up the cell, and this little fella came in named Richard, and he came in the cell. He's beaten to a pulp, folks. His lip is busted. His eyes sealed shut. I help him get cleaned up. I introduce him to a relationship with God through the program Alcoholics Anonymous. He accepted that way of life, and he left the next morning. And I'm thinking, well, that's why God put me in this confinement cell, right? Perhaps. And then the guards came. There was three or four of them. And they said, Bake, we got to put you in the... By the way, the little white guy that was in there beating up, he had come out of what's called a 5-percenter cell. 5-percenter is just another race group in prison. You have the skinheads, you have the 5-percenters, you have the Crips, and got all the different gangs and so forth. But the 5-percenters are a black group, and they practice a Islam, I think, is more of a front just to have their group together. But anyway, they hate anybody that doesn't look like them. And they had a cell with just the 5-percenters in it. And if they didn't like you and you weren't black, they would throw you in there and they would just beat you up. And they would give the 5-percenters extra food rations to do that. It was kind of a thing. And so that's where they had put Richard. The officers came to the cell and said, Bake, we got to put you in the 5-percenter cell. And either you go voluntarily or we're going to do a cell extraction. Cell extraction is a really neat term. It's not nearly as pretty as it sounds, okay? What happens is they come in with stun guns and they come in with shields with electrodes on it, and they put you on the ground in a fetal position, probably peed your pants, and then they drag you down wherever they want to go. Not a fun time. And so I kind of had a choice of one butt whooping or two. I'm not exceptionally bright, but I'll pick one every time. And so I grabbed my stuff. But you know what? I had progressed in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had formed a relationship with God that gave me a lot of power that perhaps people don't see unless you've experienced it. I was armed and dangerous with prayer and a conscious contact with God in my understanding. And so I walked down that catwalk, and they opened up the cell. There's three of them in there and me. And I put my stuff in a corner. And, you know, I had taken a pledge and made a commitment that I would no longer be violent. And unless my life depended on it, I'm not going to be a beating post. And so I stood there and I'm thinking who I needed to hit first. And the big guy, of course. And they're putting their shoes on. It's not basketball time. And they're putting their shoes on because they're getting ready to whoop me. And the guard said they'd be back in 20 minutes to take me to infirmary. So there's no mistake of what I'm going in that cell for, right? And I'm praying the third step prayer. And the serenity prayer. And the big guy stops putting his shoes on. He looks at me and says, called him by a racial name. He said, why they put you in here? Why they want you whooped? I said, I don't know. I'm a law clerk. Sometimes that happens. He stopped tying his shoe. He looked at me. And he called me a little friendlier racial name. And he said, are you that such and such law clerk back from prison working in the law library here? I said, yeah. He said, you know what? You got 9 years off my nephew's case. And that doesn't happen, folks. When the guards came back, we were playing cards. And I was winning. The guards were so mad they took the cards. So, but see, that's the God I came to know in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not only did he get on the inside of me and change me, he protected me and let me walk through 20 years of prison. I read a story in another book. I call it the Big Big Book. And the Big Big Book has a story about three cousins, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You might have read it. And they were men of uncompromising spiritual commitment, kind of like we have a spiritual commitment. And they were told that if they didn't compromise that commitment and compromise their values, that they would be executed. They said they weren't going to compromise. They were going to stick to what they knew. And so they threw them in a furnace. And in the furnace, the ruler looked in and he threw three in there. There's four. And he said, "Why is there four?" And it's because our God is with us. That's the way it was for me in prison. I wasn't alone. And so he called them out. And when they came out of the fire, they didn't even smell a smoke. Right? I thought that was pretty cool. And so I started praying that when I came out of prison, I wouldn't smell a prison. I will tell you that I'm multilingual. I do speak prison. We have a... I'll jump ahead a little bit. We own a law firm, a paralegal firm that provides paralegal assistance as criminal appellate and post-conviction attorneys in Florida. And so we get a lot of mail from prisoners, and oftentimes my wife managed the company for several years, and she would look at a letter and she says, "What is this person saying?" And I could you know, decipher that. So it's a very handy tool sometimes, you know. But where was that in the story there? So I read that story and I started praying that when I left prison, I wouldn't smell of prison. You know, you don't serve 27 years in a prison and walk out without scars. But I did. You do not walk out of prison into a job with a law firm. But I did. You do not walk out of a little 8x10 cell into a 3-bedroom home on a lake that a law firm has given you as part of your benefits package. But I did. That does not happen unless God is part of your life. It just doesn't happen. You do not get here from there unless God carries you. And he did. When I came into the program, I was told to get a black suit as soon as I could. And I was told that the reason that I needed a black suit was that if I stuck around long enough and I did the deal, that I'd go to a lot of funerals of people who did not do the deal. And if I came to the program and I didn't do the deal, they'd bury me in that suit. See, that's how serious this program is. So I walked out of prison and I immediately got involved in AA, and I immediately didn't smell of prison. People couldn't believe that I had been in prison. And I think that's a testimony of the power of this program and the supernatural power of God that we find in this program. I'm very passionate about the God component. I want to talk a little bit about that. We do not have a big book, and our literature does not promote many gods. It may surprise you, but the big book talks about there is one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, 164 pages, mentions God 281 times by the name God or title, the creator of the universe, the father of light. Different names, same person. In the Big Book and the 12 and 12, the name God with a capital G is mentioned 309 times. And yet in our society, in our fellowship, God has become, in some places, an outside issue. It better not. Because I'm telling you, if we do not keep the message of Alcoholics Anonymous pure, as it's written in our books, we're going to see more and more people fall away and die. And we already see it. The power of the program is God. My dilemma is lack of power. The solution is a relationship with God. I have a beautiful toaster on my counter. And it looks great. It's shiny. It looks like you just put the toast in there, push a little thing down. Everything works great. It does not work unless I plug it into the power source. That's exactly the way I operate. I can say the words. I can look like I belong. I can dress up pretty good. But if I don't plug into the power source every single day, I'm not going to work properly. And that's I think, so important. When Abby came to see Bill, Abby was Bill's sponsor, by the way. And if you remember that in Bill's story, he showed up at the door and Bill saw him and said, "You know what? I recognize the guy, but everything else is different." And he equated it to a religious experience. Perhaps a spiritual awakening can be a religious experience. I don't know. For me, I was dead to God and then I became alive to God. And then I never was the same. From there, I have many spiritual experiences. But when Abby told Bill, who was very, very upset, that his way appeared to be a religious experience, Abby was very careful to say, "No, you get to form your own concept of God." What he did not say is you get to create your own God. The difference is vast. I went to theology school. Another thing, like Perry, don't go to Perry, don't go to theology school. Don't go to Bible. It'll really mess you up, you know. But one of the things, some of the terms I learned is polytheism, many gods, and monotheism, one God. The writers of our literature were very monotheistic. And when that book was written, our culture was much different than it is today. Today we live in a secular, pluralistic society. Secular tells you there is no God. The government is your God. Pluralism says whatever you want is fine. Whatever makes you feel good is fine. And those are lies, as far as I'm concerned. So when I talk to my sponsees, I explain the concept of God this way. To some, I am their employer. To my wife, I am her husband. To my father, I am his son. To you, I'm your brother. I'm still just me. But each one of you has a different concept of me. You don't have to have the same concept of God that I have. It's still God. He's big enough to take you the way you approach him. And that's the way it's worked for me. Today in our home, we have a recovery home, not an official funded recovery home, but we have to check our calendars when people come in and out. We live the AA life and it's beautiful. This is one of those stories where AA boy meets AA girl on campus. And I'll tell you that in recovery, some things have happened to me that, you know what, life happens, doesn't it? I was divorced at 22 years of sobriety. Within a year of getting out, my wife decided she did not want to be on a spiritual journey with me. And I did everything I could, and I went to counseling. She wouldn't, and my sponsor said, "Keep your side of the street clean. You cannot control another person, just control yourself." And I did that. And I can look back and say I did that right. After that, it was a couple years, and I heard this woman talking in a meeting who was just so impressive, strong, and courageous. And I had the fortune of meeting her. She's with me today. And my first sentence to her was something like... Yep. That was me. And she very graciously understood. And I guess she's bilingual too. But there started a friendship that I got to marry my hero. She is amazing. We got to fly to Hawaii while I'm still on probation. And they made an allowance for me to go to Hawaii so we could get married on a beach. Ex-cons that spent 27 years in prison don't get to do that, do they? We opened up a business, and today that business is thriving. We employ 12 people, and Bryant Dwight, who is my mentor, he works for me. A couple of the law clerks that I knew in prison, they work for me. One of the guys that works for us, he and I used to take the message of Alcoholics Anonymous into a transition program for guys getting out and tell them what was possible if they worked this program. And so we got to serve together, and today we get to serve together. And he went to the Florida State Convention with me, and we shared a room. And just, you know, the life I live today is absolutely amazing. And again, you just don't get here from there. There's a we were in Crested Butte a little while ago, and Crested Butte is in Colorado. It is an amazing week-long conference. If you ever get a chance to go, unlike Perry, please go. I tell you what, you go out and see that beautiful country and the meetings that they have, and when we come to these conferences, we get to rub elbows with the people that are passionate about this program like we are. And we get to get rejuvenated and reinvigorated by that joint passion and take it back to our home groups and so forth. And Crested Butte is one of those places. And I was privileged to speak there. And I was awakened at about 3 a.m. I'm an early riser anyway, but not that early. But I had something on my... God had just put something right between my eyes that I needed to get up and do. I had read a little writing from years previous. And it was written by a young man in Africa. And that young man was, again, like the three cousins that I talked about a little earlier. He was an uncompromisingly spiritually based man. And he was told in this little village in Africa that if he did not renounce his faith in God, that he would be executed. He was executed. The night before his execution, he wrote what's called the Fellowship of the Unashamed. You can read that yourself, but what was put on my heart to write was the fellowship, the AA Fellowship of the Unashamed. And I'd like to close by reading that to you. And perhaps it can be a call of arms. I can give you a copy if you want. It's important for me sometimes to just get back to basics. You know, if I never left the basics, I wouldn't have to get back to the basics, right? But life is life. And this is what I wrote at 3 o'clock in the morning. This was adopted from a story told by Robert Moorhead, a young Christian man from Rwanda, who was forced by his tribe in 1980 to renounce Christ or face death. He refused to renounce Christ, and he was murdered on the spot. The night before, he had written the following commitment, which was found in his room. Now, I revised this to be more applicable to us in this fellowship. I am part of the Fellowship of the Unashamed. The die has been cast. I have stepped over the line. The decision has been made. I am a recovering alcoholic and part of the family of God. I won't look back, let up, slow down, back away, or be still. My past is redeemed. My present makes sense. And my future is secure. I am finished and done with low living, sight walking, small planning, smooth knees, colorless dreams, tame visions, mundane talking, chintzy giving, and dwarf goals. I no longer need preeminence, prosperity, position, promotions, plaudits, or popularity. I don't have to be right, first, tops, recognized, praised, regarded, or rewarded. I now live by tolerance, learn by faith, love by patience, lift by prayer, and labor by power. My pace is set. My steps are principled. My goal is heaven. My road is narrow. My way is rough. My companions are beautiful. My guide is reliable. My mission is clear. I cannot be bought, compromised, deterred, lured away, turned back, deluded, or delayed. I will not flinch in the face of sacrifice, hesitate in the presence of adversity, negotiate at the table of insanity, ponder at the pool of popularity, or meander in the maze of mediocrity. I won't give up, back up, let up, or shut up until I've carried the message. The message of love, hope, joy, freedom, and the transformational power of God through the program Alcoholics Anonymous to the ends of my world. I am a recovered alcoholic. I must go until my last breath, give until I drop, carry the message until all know, and work this program until I leave this planet for my home with God in heaven. And when I leave here for there, I'll meet those who have gone before for that big meeting in the sky and await you who are part of the fellowship A fellowship of unashamed. Remember the judge? I got to meet him. It was a law conference. I had forgiven him by that time. I walked up to him and I shook his hand. And I thanked him for sending me to AA, because at that time I had 22 years of sobriety thanks to him sending me to AA. And I also thanked him for sending me to prison. As insane as that sounds, I know today that every ingredient in my past are part of who I am today, just like you. Thank you for letting me share.